Blog Talk Radio.
Delilah, this is your ex-boyfriend Samson, and I know you thought that lifting weights made me so buff and handsome. You were wrong. It's 'cause I let my hair grow long that makes me strong. Hey there, Delilah, you came in while I was sleeping, and I couldn't feel you cutting, and I didn't hear you creeping out the door. You left my hair piled on the floor while I just snore. Oh, what you did to me, oh, while I was asleep. Oh, I'm a Nazarene, oh, but you shaved me clean. Delilah, you're so mean. I killed a lion big and mean and slaughtered many Philistines, all with the donkey's jawbone, that's no lie. But now I'm chained up to the wall, and I can't cry no tears at all, because they came and gouged out both my eyes. Why'd you grab your clipping shears and shave my head like Britney Spears? And now I'm standing here in total shame, and you're to blame. Hey there, Delilah, why did you have to me? And it's hard for me to think, not long ago I wanted you to be my bride. but you took too much off the side. Hey there, Delilah, when you die, just tell the devil I said hi, and he'll know why. Oh, it's what you did to me. Oh, now I feel so weak. Oh, I look like a freak. You know, Delilah, you're a geek. Oh, you're such a geek.
Everyone, and welcome to your place. We weren't on the air last week due to our son and his wife being in an accident. It was physical injury, but we definitely saw the grace and mercy of God in keeping them from being hurt worse or even killed. So tonight we are bringing you that scheduled show. Tonight we are moving into the book of Judges, and as always, while Bill said the teacher brought out some things in a way that he had never thought before. As you can tell from the starting song that Bill put together, obedience is very important to living for God. Today, to say you believe the Bible means that you have to obey what it tells us on how we should live. How many of us have so much potential that is God-given and we throw it all away because of our own lust? It is easy to judge Samson, but we should be sure that we are holding ourselves to the same level of accountability. We hate to admit it, but our pattern is not that much different from what we read of others in the Bible. We have to make a decision to obey or disobey, but you can't justify your way out of taking responsibility for your actions. As always, you can ask questions or make a comment at the end of the show. And now, let's have a listen.
Well, welcome back. We're going into the book of Judges today. In the book of Joshua, we conquered the land. Well, I have to add a little parenthesis to that. We didn't really conquer the land. We subdued the land, but there are still significant pockets of resistance, particularly on the coastline with the Philistines, and among a number of other people in the Central Mountain Range. So the land, nonetheless, has been divided up, allocated to the tribes, and people are now settling in. In the book of Joshua, we have conquest. In the book of Judges, we have settlement. It's a mistake, however, to think that in the book of Judges, we have a nation, Israel, that has conquered another set of nations and now has their own land. They are far from a nation. Israel at this point is simply a loose confederation of 12 tribes, each tribe within its own tribal territory. And those territories, as we noted last time, are marked out by natural, geographic, and topographical boundaries. And they have very little intercourse with one another as day-to-day life goes on. They're a loose confederation of 12 tribes. But with that conquest of the land and this loose confederation living in the land, obviously the control that Israel exerts over the land is shaky at best. And given that shakiness of control, other nations are going to invade and try to take over. Edom from the south east, Moab a little bit north of Edom, Ammon north of Moab, Syria or Aram from the north, the Philistines on the coastal plain, all will be making continuous incursions into the land. And when that happens, the tribes will coalesce together and they will resist that incursion. And once the threat is over, they diminish back into a loose confederation of 12 tribes. As the tribes coalesce together, a leader will emerge. And that leader is referred to in the book of Judges as a judge. I think that's an unfortunate translation because we think of a judge having a judicial job. that is, dealing with legal affairs and making decisions regarding legal events. That's not what the judges do. There are 13 judges in the book of Judges, and only one of them has a judicial function. That's judge number 4, and her name is Deborah. She's the only female leader. But all the others are simply military leaders who emerge and deal with a particular threat. Now, you would think that after the conquest of the land, we have the land itself. The Israelites are now living in the promised land. We have the Word of God. God physically manifested in the midst of the people in the form of the pillar of cloud and fire. You would think everything would be going just fine. After all, that generation that conquered the land was a pretty tough group of people. However, we read in Judges chapter 2 at verse 10, after that whole generation, that is, the generation that conquered the land, had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. A whole new generation grew up that knew absolutely nothing about God or what God had done for the Israelites. So how'd that happen? You might recall back in Deuteronomy chapter 6 at verses 4 through 9. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands. Bind them on your forehead. Teach your children. Teach the next generation about God. Because if you don't, they're not going to know about God. You don't learn about God through osmosis. Someone has to teach you. And if you don't teach the next generation, they simply will not know. That does not know God is a generation that is bound for trouble. And that's exactly what happens here in Judges. When the generation that conquered the land died, a whole new generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. So what happens when that occurs? Judges chapter 2, verse 11. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served Baal. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the people around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and Ashtoreth. So what did they do? They turn away from God, they get into trouble, and they end up in servitude. In fact, we're going to find in the book of Judges, with 13 judges, and each of these judges emerges when an outside threat pushes into Israel. As each judge emerges and deals with the threat, then recedes to the background, well, we find a pattern that begins to form. In fact, we might think of this pattern as the hands on a clock. Follow them around the clock. At 12 o'clock, we have a nation serving God. A nation starting out as they should. When the hand moves to 1 o'clock, the nation does evil in God's sight. At 2 o'clock, they forsake God. At 3 o'clock, they follow their own way. At 4 o'clock, they encounter depression and war. At 5 o'clock, they are sold into slavery. And at 6 o'clock, they are a nation in servitude. So we move from a nation serving God at 12 o'clock to a nation in servitude at 6 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, they cry out to God. At 8 o'clock, they turn back to God. At 9 o'clock, they repent of what they've done. At 10 o'clock, God raises up a judge to deal with the external threat. At 11 o'clock, the people are delivered from their servitude. And at 12 o'clock, they are back to serving God. So we have the hands go around the clock 13 separate times. But with each time the hand goes around the clock, the whole clock spirals downward one notch. In other words, at the beginning, the judges are pretty good. By the end, they're not. In fact, at the end of Judges, in Judges chapter 21 at verse 25. In those days, Israel had no king, and everyone did that which was right in his own eyes. By the end of Judges, you have to ask yourself, whatever happened to the plan of salvation? So as we move into the book of Judges, and the first generation, the conquest generation, dies off, a whole generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done. And we read in chapter 3 at verse 5 that the Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons, and they served other gods. Well, here we are, moving into deep trouble. The first judge, in chapter 3, verse 7, is a man named Othniel. And we read, and they fall into servitude to another nation. The Lord then raises up a leader, Othniel, who deals with this problem, and we're back to a nation serving God. The second judge, Ehud. I rather like Ehud. At verse 12, once again, here goes the hand around the clock. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and because they did this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, king of Moab, to the southeast, Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel. The Moabites invade from the southeast. Getting the Ammonites and Amalekites to join him, that is, his natural allies on the east side of the Jordan River, Eglon came and attacked Israel, and they took possession of the city of palms, that would be Jericho. When the Israelites invaded the land, they started at Jericho. That's the natural point to begin the invasion. Well, Eglon and his followers invaded as well, and they begin with Jericho. Now, the Israelites were subject to Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. The hand rests at 6 o'clock for 18 years. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and he gave them a deliverer, Ehud, a left-handed man, and the son of Gera the Benjamite. Now that's a really curious note, a left-handed man. Why are we told that? We shall see. The Israelites sent him with tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. And now Ehud, the left-handed man from the tribe of Benjamin, made a double-edged sword about a foot and a half long. That is, he made a dagger with a 6-inch handle and a 12-inch blade. And it was sharp on both sides. And he strapped it to his right thigh under his clothing. So he strapped the dagger to the inside of his right thigh underneath his garments. Now he presented the tribute to Eglon, that is, the money demanded by Eglon, who was a very fat man. Now, after Ehud had presented the tribute, he sent on their way the men who had carried it. Now, at the idols near Gilgal, he himself turned back and said, "By the way, king, I have a secret message for you." The king said, "Out, everyone, quiet." At this, his attendants left him. And we have a private meeting between the king, Eglon, and Ehud. Ehud approached him while he was sitting alone in the upper room of his summer palace and said, "I have a message from God." "Really?" Eglon stood up. And Ehud reached out as he would to embrace the king and whisper the message in his ear. And as he embraced the king with his right hand and leaned in to whisper in the king's ear, with his left hand, he reached beneath his garment, drew out the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. Even the handle sank in after the blade, which came out his back. Ooh. Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed over it. With that, Ehud let go of the king, who dropped like a sack of potatoes to the ground. Then Ehud went out on the porch, shut the doors of the upper room, and locked them. And he left. Now, after he had gone, the king's servants came and found the doors of the upper room locked. That's odd. He must be relieving himself in the inner room of the house. Well, they waited and waited to the point of embarrassment. And when he didn't open the door, they found the keys and unlocked the door. And there they saw their Lord, fallen on the floor, dead. Meanwhile, Ehud got away, and he passed by the idols and escaped to Syria. When he arrived there, he blew a trumpet, he summoned the army, he rallied the troops, and the Moabites are kicked out of the land. Ehud, the left-handed man from the tribe of Benjamin. Now, here's something that hardly anybody knows, unless you've been in my classes. Of all the people in the Bible specifically mentioned as being left-handed, and there are three of them, specifically mentioned as being left-handed, every single one of them is from the tribe of Benjamin. Now, isn't that odd? How many left-handed people do we have in class? Right? What, one, two, three, four? Only a small number. Are you all from the tribe of Benjamin? You know? Only the tribe of Benjamin. Left-handed men. Well, we move on. Judge number three, Shamgar. That's in chapter 3, verse 31. And he only gets one verse. After Ehud came Shamgar, son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He too saved Israel. We don't know much about him, but he must have been one tough character to strike down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. And we move on to judge number four. And I want to spend time on this story, the story of Deborah. She's the only female leader to emerge. And we have to ask, why is a woman leading Israel at this point? Well, look at the story. After Ehud died, judge number two, the Israelites once again did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So here goes a hand around the clock. They do evil in the eyes of the Lord. So the Lord sold them into the hands of Yabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. If you look at a map of Israel and you follow the Via Maris north, directly above the Sea of Galilee is Hazor. Hazor is a fortress overlooking the Via Maris, and it controls the traffic on the Via Maris moving from the north to the south. Traffic moving from the south to the north is controlled by the fortress at Megiddo, right at the entrance to the Jezreel Valley. If you're going to control the Via Maris, and hence the international trade route and the economy of the ancient world, you have to control the fortress at Megiddo and at Hazor. Well, we have Yabin controlling the Via Maris at Hazor. Now, why was he able to do this? Well, he had a commander, a general named Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim, and he had 900 iron chariots. That was the top technology of its day. That was like saying he had 900 M1 Abrams tanks, and the Israelites had sticks and stones. He controlled with advanced technology and massive power. And he cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years. So here we are, hands at 6 o'clock. Now, Deborah, a prophetess and the wife of Lapidoth, was leading Israel at that time. Again, why was a woman leading Israel at this time? We haven't seen that before, and we're hardly ever going to see it again. She held court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel. That's just north of Israel of today, in the hill country of Ephraim. And the Israelites came to her to have their disputes decided. So of all 13 judges, she's the only one who has a judicial function, and we see her exercising that function at the palm of Deborah. That's the place you would go to see her. Now, she sent for Barak, son of Ahinoam, from Kedesh in Naphtali. And she said to him, "The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go, take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun, and lead the way to Mount Tabor." Mount Tabor is in the Jezreel Valley. It's not really a mountain. The Jezreel Valley is flat as a pancake. It's a hill in the middle of the Jezreel Valley that stands out prominently because of the flat land surrounding it. "Go to Mount Tabor. I will lure Sisera, Yabin's commanding general, with his 900 iron chariots. I will lure him to Mount Tabor with his chariots and his troops and give him into your hands." Barak said to her, with a hearty aye, aye, sir, no. He said to her, if you go with me, I'll go. If you don't go with me, I won't go. Well, this is a great way for a commanding general to talk. Deborah is disgusted. And she said, very well, I will go with you. But because of the way you're going about this, the honor will not be yours. For the Lord will hand Sisera over to a woman. So Deborah went with Barak to Kedesh, where he summoned Zebulun and Naphtali. 10,000 men followed him, and Deborah also went with him. Now, Heber the Kenite had left the other Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law, and pitched his tent by the great tree in Zaanaim near Kedesh. Heber the Kenite, the clan of the Kenites, were metal workers. So why does he leave Israel and pitch his camp near Hazor, where the enemy is? Well, because they have 900 iron chariots and they need metal workers to work on the chariots. There's work with the enemy. We might even think of Heber as something of a collaborator with the people oppressing Israel. Now, when they told Sisera, verse 12, that Barak, son of Ahinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera thought, an incipient rebellion. I'll squash that in a heartbeat. Sisera gathered together his 900 iron chariots and all the men with him, and they headed for the Jezreel Valley and Mount Tabor. And then Deborah said to Barak, go, this is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Has not the Lord gone ahead of you? So Barak went down Mount Tabor, followed by 10,000 men. At Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and army by the sword, and Sisera abandoned his chariot and fled on foot. Well, how does this happen? Over in chapter 5, we have the Song of Deborah, a great song of celebration and thanksgiving for the victory over Sisera. And we read in chapter 5 at verse 4. O Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the land of Edom, the earth shook. The heavens poured. The clouds poured down rain. The mountains quaked before the Lord, the one of Sinai, before the Lord, the God of Israel. The earth shook and the heavens poured. That is, as Sisera began his attack, a gigantic storm broke out. Rain in buckets full came down in the Jezreel Valley. That Jezreel Valley, flat as a pancake, surrounded by mountains. What happens with a thunderstorm in a valley? It floods, and the ground gets wet and muddy and soft. And what happens to 900 iron chariots when they're in the mud? They sink down in the mud. What was an asset has now become a liability, and the Israelites are able to defeat Yabin's army. So, Sisera, the commanding general of Yabin's army, is thoroughly routed and runs for his life. Back over in verse 17, chapter 4. Sisera, however, fled on foot to the tent of Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Where can he go? Well, Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, whom we might think of as a collaborator with the men of Hazor, he's friendly. I'll go there. There were friendly relations between the king of Hazor and the clan of the Kenites. Yael, the wife, went out to meet Sisera. Oh, you look terrible, she said. What has happened? Oh, come, my lord, come right in. Don't be afraid. Sisera is quaking in his boots. He is scared to death. He is exhausted. He has lost his entire army. And Yael said, oh, you poor thing, come right in. He entered the tent, and she put a covering over him. Oh, you're all wet and you're cold. Here, let me put this nice blanket around you. I'm thirsty, he said. Please give me some water. Oh, here, lie down here. Take those wet things off. Lie down. Oh, cover you up with a blanket. And she did give him a drink of water. She opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him up. Now, who lies down and a woman covers him up and gives him a bottle of milk? A baby, right? And that's exactly what Sisera is. And then he said, stand in the doorway of the tent. If anyone comes by, tell them no one's here. Oh, I will do that. You go right to sleep. I'll protect you. It will be okay. Sisera fell sound asleep with a nice blue blankie over him and a bottle of milk. But Yael, Heber's wife, as Sisera lay sleeping, picked up a tent peg and a mallet and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. She knelt down beside him. She stroked his hair. He was sleeping on his side with his face tucked under on the blanket. And she stroked his hair, and she took the tent peg and placed it against his temple, and with the mallet, whack, smacked the tent peg. It went through his temple and into the ground. And he died. Yeah, I guess he did. That tent peg was the last thing that went through his mind, wasn't it? Well, Barak came in pursuit of Sisera, and Yael went out to meet him. Come, she said, I'll show you the man you're looking for. So he went in with her, and there lay Sisera with the tent peg through his temple, stuck into the ground, dead. On that day, God subdued Jabin, the Canaanite king, before the Israelites, and the hand of the Israelites grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, the Canaanite king, until they destroyed him. So we have the hands going back up to 12 o'clock to a nation serving God. In chapter 5, we have that great song of thanksgiving and praise, the song of Deborah. And on we move. We move into judge number 5, Gideon. Gideon is a good story all in itself and a long one. And we're going to pass over that. Who I'd like to look at among the 13 judges. We start out strongly. Deborah is a strong leader. And she's a woman. The question, why is a woman leading Israel? Well, you met the men in this story. That about answers it, doesn't it? You know, the men have abdicated their responsibility. Someone has to do it, and Deborah stepped forward and filled the gap. But after her, we have a series of judges, and as the hand goes around the clock 13 times, each time the hand circles the clock, the whole clock spins downward one notch. Until we get to the very end, our 13th judge is a man we all know, a man named Samson. Judges chapter 13, judge number 13, Samson. Now, if you picture in your mind Samson, who do you think of? Well, I suppose it depends on your generation, but I think of Victor Mature in the 1949 film Samson and Delilah. Delilah, played by Hedy Lamarr, and promoted as the world's greatest seductress. Victor Mature, he was a pretty studly dude at the time. Those of you in a younger generation might think of a young Arnold. But no, we would both be wrong. If you picture Samson as he truly was, you would picture Don Knotts. Because no one knows where his strength comes from. If he looked like a young Arnold, you wouldn't have to ask, where does his strength come from? They're stunned and surprised. What's the source of his strength? It's clearly not his young Arnold-like physique. What could it be? Well, chapter 13, verse 1. We'll look closely at the story. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, so here goes the hand around the clock again. So the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years, the Philistines on the coastal plain. Notice in the story of Deborah, it's the Canaanite king Jabin up north. Earlier with Ehud, it was the Moabite king in the southeast in league with the eastern tribes. Now it's on the west, on the coastal plain, the Philistines. each of the surrounding enemies gets their turn at trying to take control of this land. Now, the Philistines, and this is pretty serious, because the Philistines were never conquered by Israel during Joshua. In fact, when the tribes are divided, the tribal lands are divided among the tribe of Dan is given the coastal plain, the Philistine territory, but they never take it. They never subdue it. In fact, the tribe of Dan, we're going to see at the end of Judges, rejects the land God gave them and goes north to look for something that's easier pickings because they cannot defeat the Philistines. Nobody will defeat the Philistines until the time of David. David will defeat the Philistines. How does he do it? Well, at about 20 years old, David went on the run. King Saul looked to have him assassinated, and David went on the run for 10 years. David works as a mercenary for the Philistines. He knows how the Philistines operate. And when David becomes king, he defeats the Philistines very easily because he knew how they operated. Well, it won't be a while until that happens. But here with Samson, well, his job will be to deal with the Philistines. So the Philistines were oppressing Israel for 40 years. Now, a certain man of Zorah named Manoah from the clan of the Danites had a wife who was sterile and remained childless. Well, that's an ongoing theme. How many women have we met in the Bible who are unable to have children and, by miraculous intervention of God, have a child? Well, start with Sarah, Abraham and Sarah. How about Rebekah and Isaac? How about Jacob and Rachel? The story goes on. All the way through Samson, into the next book, Samuel. Samuel's mother was sterile and unable to have a child. And how about all the way up into the Gospels themselves, where Mary is in a position where she is unable to have a child, she's young, and she's not married. She's a virgin. We have the theme develop all the way through the Bible. Well, here we have it again with Samson. Now, chapter 13, at verse 2, a certain man of Zorah named Manoah from the clan of the Danites had a wife who was sterile and remained childless. But the angel of the Lord appeared to her and said, "You are sterile and childless." And she said, "Big news. And you're going to conceive and have a son." Oh, that is big news. "Now, see to it that you drink no wine or other fermented drink and that you do not eat anything unclean, because you will conceive and give birth to a son. No razor may be used on his head, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth." Set apart to God from birth. Now, we read about the Nazarite vow in Numbers chapter 6. Anyone, male or female, can take a Nazarite vow. It's a vow of separation to God, and it's for a temporary period of time. It's a time when you leave behind all obligations of family and community, and you set apart that time and yourself to God and God alone. Think of it in today's terms as going on a week-long retreat off to a monastery where you leave behind your normal everyday life. You leave behind your iPhone and your iPod and your computer and all the other things of normal day-to-day life, and you set that time apart to God and God alone. It's an extraordinary thing to do and quite an important thing to do periodically, to set aside time for God where it's just you and God. Anyone can do that. That's the Nazarite vow. And during the period of that separation to God, you don't do the things you ordinarily do. You don't drink wine. You don't cut your hair. You don't do your makeup and all those kind of things. You simply spend time with God. And the hair that grows during that time, when the vow ends, you cut off the hair that grew during the period of separation to God, and you offer that hair along with your normal great offering of the burnt offering, grain offering, peace offering, sin offering, guilt offering. You offer that hair as a sign or a symbol of the time that you spent with God. It's an outward symbol of that time, the hair that grew during the period of the vow. Of course, you think of the haircuts later on. Paul took a Nazarite vow, and at that point, well, it became pretty elaborate, and you would shave your whole head. Well, that wasn't the point. The point was the hair that grew during the period of the vow, but as it became elaborate, you shave your whole head and walk around bald, and people say, ooh, he had a Nazarite vow, holy fellow, right? It became an outward show of your piety when you did that. But in Numbers chapter 6, you simply cut the hair that grew during the period of the vow as a symbol of the time you spent with God. So this fellow, Samson, is a Nazarite from birth. He's a lifelong Nazarite. That's not what a Nazarite vow is for. A Nazarite vow is a temporary period of time where you're set apart to God. But some people in the Bible are lifelong Nazarites. They're Nazarites because their parents took the vow on their behalf for the rest of their life. There are very few lifelong Nazarites. Samson is one. Samuel in 1 Samuel will be one. And John the Baptist is one up in the Gospels. And that's about all I can think of. They are so unusual, they're notable, and each one plays a significant role in the plan of salvation. So think of a Nazarite vow as a temporary period of time. But there are a few lifelong Nazarites. We meet our first one here with Samson. Now, what's his job to be? He's set apart to God from birth. And his job will be, at the end of verse 5, to begin the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines. He is the one who will begin the defeat of the Philistines. But what does he do, in fact? Samson grows up. He's a young man now, chapter 14. And Samson went down to Timnah in Philistine territory, and he saw there a young Philistine woman. And when he returned, he said to his father and mother. Now, typically, when you have a son born to a woman who is unable to have children, except through the miraculous intervention of God, that child tends to be, well, the center of his mother's life and his father's life. That child tends to be a spoiled brat. And you can understand why. Samson went down, he saw this young Philistine girl, and when he returned home, he said to his father and mother, I have seen a Philistine woman in Timnah, get her for me as my wife. What young fellow says to his parents, get that girl for me as a wife? I can see him stamping his foot when he says it. His father and mother replied, isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives or your own people? Must you go to these uncircumcised Philistines for a wife? Can't you find a nice Jewish girl? Samson said to his father, stamping his foot, get her for me. She's the right one for me. Well, they do. They go down to Timnah, and along the way, at verse 8, sometime later he went to marry her, and he turned aside to look at a lion's carcass. In it was a swarm of bees. Well, earlier, just a few verses above, as he's going down to Philistine territory, at verse 5.5, as they approached the vineyards of Timnah, suddenly a young lion came roaring out toward him, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power, and he tore the lion apart with his bare hands. Samson leaps to the occasion, takes hold of the lion, and rips it apart with his bare hands. Now that is real strength. And he leaves the carcass lying. There are only three people in the Bible who killed a lion with their bare hands. Samson, David, and another fellow who worked for David, really tough character, Benaiah, son of Jehoiada. Three men in the Bible kill a lion with their bare hands. Only one man outside the Bible kills a lion with his bare hands, and that would be Hercules. So if you can kill a lion with your bare hands, you're in pretty good company. Samson is one of these guys. But how did he do it? The Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power, and he ripped that lion apart. Now, later on, in verse 8, when he went back to marry the girl, there was a lion carcass, and it had a swarm of bees in it, and some honey. The bees had made a nest in the rotting carcass of the lion. Does that happen? Well, actually it does. I was in the Negev southern portion of Israel for a few weeks. And early on, when I first got there, we were driving along down the road, and there was a dead camel lying next to the road. Talk about roadkill. It was gigantic roadkill. It was a dead camel. Wow, look at that. Later on, 3 weeks later, coming back, we passed the same carcass. It was still lying there. And it looked like it had deflated. It was flat. And we stopped to look at the dead camel. And there were bees all around the camel, and they had made a nest in the carcass of the camel. Well, Samson bent down and scooped out some honey and ate it. I was not about to eat honey from the dead carcass of a camel that had been lying there for 3 weeks. But it happened. So on they went. In verse 10, his father went down to see the woman, and Samson made a feast there. And it was customary for bridegrooms to have a big celebration. And when he appeared, he was given 30 companions. Now, these are not 30 Philistine friends. These are 30 men who are there to watch his every move, because the Philistines are oppressing the Israelites. They don't trust them. And now we have an Israelite coming into the Philistine community, and he has given people to keep an eye on him. Much the way when you travel to some countries in the world and you have a guide, well, the person may very well be a guide, but he's also there to keep an eye on you and report to his superiors what you're doing. Samson knew this, and he provoked them. He said to them, "Let me tell you a riddle. If you can give me the answer within 7 days of the great feast, I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. If you can tell me the answer to the riddle, I will give you 30 brand new custom-tailored canali suits. If you can't tell me, then you have to give me 30 brand new custom-tailored canali suits." They said, "Whatever, let's hear it." He said, "Out of the eater, something to eat. Out of the strong, something sweet. What is it?" Well, for 3 days, they couldn't figure that one out. And on the fourth day, they said to Samson's wife, that is, the girl he's engaged to marry, they said to her, "Coax your husband into explaining the riddle. If you don't, we'll huff and puff and blow your house down and kill you and your family." Samson's wife threw herself on him, sobbing, "Here we are a week before the wedding, and you hate me. You don't really love me. You've given my people a riddle, and you haven't even told me the answer." And Samson replied, "I haven't even told Mama and Papa. Why should I tell you?" So she cried for the entire 7 days of the feast. On the seventh day, he finally told her, because it was unbearable. She's weeping and sniveling, and every time you looked at her, she's squirting tears. "You don't love me. You won't." Finally, he gave in and told her. Now, before sunset on the seventh day of the feast, the men of the town said, "Oh, about the riddle, what is sweeter than honey, and what is stronger than a lion?" Well, Samson realized that the girl had betrayed him, and he said to them in a terrific insult to her, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have solved my riddle." Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power. He went to Ashkelon, struck down 30 of their men, stripped them of their clothing, and gave the 30 sets of clothes to the 30 spies. Burning with anger, he went up to his father's house, and Samson's wife was given to someone else to marry. What do we learn from this story about the character of Samson? He is a spoiled, petulant brat. Well, he's supposed to begin the defeat of the Philistines, but what does he do? He just fools around with Philistine girls. Well, in chapter 16, Samson went to Gaza, where he saw a prostitute. Gaza is on the coastal plain, Philistine territory. And one day, Samson went to see a prostitute in Gaza. He's got this thing for Philistine girls. Well, a little bit later, verse 4, he fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was the famous or infamous Delilah. another Philistine girl. Valley of Sorek is in Philistine territory. Now the rulers of the Philistines went to her and said, "See if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength. Because looking at him, looking just like Don Knotts, where did this strength come from? How can we overpower him and tie him up and capture him? If you can find out the secret to his strength, we will give you 1,100 shekels of silver. We'll pay you for it." So Delilah said, "Fine." She said to Samson one night, as they're lying in bed, and you have to understand the erotic undertones of the story, "Oh, Samson, tell me the secret of your great strength and how you could..." Samson thought this sounded like a good game. So he said, "Well, if anyone ties me with 7 fresh thongs, I become as weak as any other man." So that's exactly what she did. Samson allows himself to be tied up with 7 fresh thongs, and the fun begins. But in the midst of it all, Delilah said, "There are Philistines in the closet." He snapped the thongs as easily as a piece of string and beat up the Philistines. Well, this happens over and over again. She said to him in verse 10, "You made a fool of me. You lied to me." Now tell me, batting her eyes, how can you be tied up? He said, "Well, if anyone ties me with new ropes, and we do this and that and the other thing." Finally, she's totally humiliated in front of her friends. And in verse 15, she said to him, "How can you say I love you when you won't confide in me? This is the third time you made a fool of me." With such nagging, she prodded him day after day after day until he was sick to death of it. So he told her everything. "All right, here's the deal. No razor has ever been used on my head. I've never had a haircut. Samson is what, 20 years old? He has hair down to his butt, a beard that's never been trimmed. No razor has ever touched my hair. I've been a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth. If my head were shaved, my strength would leave me. All the hair that grew from the day Samson was born until this day is a sign or a symbol of the time that he has been set apart to God. If my hair were cut," what's the source of his strength? Not his hair. The source of his strength is God. He has been set apart to God from birth as a Nazarite to do a particular job, which is defeating the Philistines. He said, "If I were to have my hair cut, what would that mean? It would mean his Nazarite vow was over. He would voluntarily end his Nazarite vow. And once the Nazarite vow is ended, he no longer has that job to do for God, and the gift God has given him to accomplish the job, his strength, would be removed." And that's exactly what happens. When he's sound asleep, she cut off all of his hair. She said, "The Philistines are upon you." And sure enough, that gift of strength was gone. The strength is the gift from God to accomplish the job. But in having his hair cut, he has voluntarily ended the vow, and the gift is removed. Well, they capture him and make a fool of him. Down in verse 23, the rulers of the Philistines assembled for a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and they brought Samson out to perform like a little dancing monkey, and sure enough, he's weak and pitiful. Oh, and by the way, they had gouged out his eyes. They brought him out for a little entertainment. And blind, pitiful Samson, as he's brought out, led out, said to the man leading him out, "Would you please place my hands on the pillars so I know where I am?" He did. And as Samson stood with his hands on the pillars of the temple, at verse 28, he prayed to the Lord, "Oh, sovereign Lord, remember me, O God. Allow me to accomplish the purpose you put me here for." No, he said, "Remember me, O God, strengthen me one more time, and let me get revenge on the Philistines for my eyes." God provides that gift of strength one final time. Samson pushes on the pillars. The temple of Dagon collapses on the Philistines, and Samson and the whole crowd inside die. Did he do the job he was called by God to do? No. to the very end, he's fooling around with the Philistine girls. And at the very end, he doesn't defeat the Philistines. He wants strength for his own purpose, to get revenge for what they did to me. You see how the quality of the judges has diminished as we pass through 13 judges. Well, these are dark times indeed for the Israelites. Horrible things happen, and by the end of Judges, in those days, Israel had no king. They're not speaking of Saul or David or Solomon. They're yet to come. They're speaking of God. In these days, Israel didn't even no longer recognize God as their king. And everyone did that which was right in his own eyes. When we get to the end of the book of Judges, we're at the end of a linear narrative to this point. The story began in Genesis, chapter 1, verse 1, and we moved in a straight line. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges. It's a straight chronological linear narrative. And where do we find ourselves? In those days, Israel no longer even recognized God, and everyone did what he darn well pleased. It was a time of utter and total moral, religious, political, and economic chaos. Dark days indeed. In fact, when you get to the end of Judges, if you turn around and look back, you see a charred, smoking, and bloody landscape. And whatever happened to the plan of salvation? Because it sure looks, at the end of Judges, like the whole thing has disappeared. The Israelites have not done what God has asked them to do. Quite the opposite. They have become even worse than the people who were living in that land to begin with. As we saw at the beginning of Judges, in those days, when that generation that conquered the land died, in those days, a whole generation grew up that knew nothing about God. And in chapter 3, verse 5, the Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons, and they served their God. That's where we are at the end of Judges. Is there any hope? Is there a glimmer of hope for the plan of salvation? I'll leave you on a cliffhanger till next time.
Well, we can hardly wait. This has been the Book of Judges and a very interesting lesson tonight, Blog Talk Mom.
Well, hello, Sister Starla and Wild Bill. Yes, this has. I agree with you. This is especially the way the last words of the timeline from Genesis to Judges, and it just played right out into, I guess, what we're living in today. You know, we've just sort of evolved into perverting the actual Word of God. And I like this teacher a lot. It speaks to my heart. I've been studying the last few weeks on Genesis with the first 11 chapters. Ken Ham teaches on that for the creation versus evolution, and it's just excellent. And this has complemented it in my mind. It's very, very good. I didn't quite ever catch that before. I like the clock, like you started out saying, you know, how they just, like every 5 minutes, literally, but you could see how it was gradually, they would move away, and each step took them a little bit more into servitude, and I love the way he described that. I'm going to use that. So this was sure, and I like the way that he brought out about Samson. You know, it's obvious that Samson had ideals that were not really focused on pleasing God. His own ego, you know, was involved so much. But I don't think I quite ever caught that he never really wanted to please God. He wanted the gifts. He wanted to be able to use the strength.
Yeah.
But he didn't. He wasn't really interested. Even at death, it was to revenge himself. And that really spoke to my heart. I'm also thinking a lot about just studying, not leaving, like you said, the plan of salvation. Because there's so many directions to go But the Word of God is the Word of God, and it isn't difficult to see the path if you just want to. So have you noticed that with so many churches that have denominations that have left the planned route, so to speak? You know, they have a form of godliness, but they've just left the plan that so seems like so plain in the Bible about how to be saved. Nicodemus, be born, you know, Jesus told him, be born again. And how do you be born again? By the water and the Spirit. And I know Wild Bill probably bring out the plan of salvation, but it's so beautiful. And we want to do it the way God planned it. You know, don't leave the way God planned it, because it's always going away from God and not towards Him. And then I've heard more people, seemingly, I guess this past week or so, are feeling that the rapture is so near, and they're really preaching to people to be prepared, be ready. Don't think about all of the things that we don't know and we can argue about, but be ready. Keep our eyes on the Lord and on His Word. Have you heard many, I don't know about Wild Bill, or have y'all been studying and preaching lately about the rapture?
Well, not as such, but I have heard, you know, you see it everywhere. Everybody, you know, is saying to be ready.
I like what you say, that, you know, be ready, whatever. You know, you may not know the exact day or hour or whatever is coming into our political world and all that, but we need to be ready just at all times. Just know that we have our focus on the Lord. And it's just really interesting how many opinions there are right now. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. I'm not criticizing anybody. It's just that it's time for us to let the Word of God be our foundation. Let it be the absolute foundation for our decisions, for our everything, our choices that we make, the ambitions and focus that we have. And I really want that. I desire that. I'm working with several groups right now, and they're young people, different ages, and they don't have a clue what the Bible says at all. And there seems to be a focus on the supernatural, but it's more in humanism. It's not in a different realm. It's not what the Bible says. So we've got our work cut out for us. Ever seemed like years ago it was easier to just have Bible studies, you know, just go out, knock on doors, offer a Bible study. But it is not that easy. For me, I'm running into people that do not understand the vocabulary that we use in church. They just don't understand. And so you have to be so very basic with just several different, I've got several situations going right now. But I just to bring it around to the fact that God gave me the opportunity to have three albums to rap, more and more I feel the presence of God when I talk about it, because it's not about me. I was just privileged to have any part to do with it. But it was God reaching out in the most simple, simplistic way until the plan of salvation, and to talk about standing up, wake up, serve God, take on the whole armor of God. You know, the prodigal son, the lost sheep. I'm amazed at how God used it. And I appreciate Wild Bill for when he plays some of them on this program. And the different denominations have invited me to share with them how it came about. And I'm very grateful. And I'm awestruck at how God can just, he just knows how to do it. And I love Him. He is an awesome God in every way. Were there any things that Wild Bill going to get to be with us tonight?
No, I don't think so. He is getting ready for work.
There was another thing that, you know, Satan delighted in, like Samson was, they gouged out his eyes, you know, just Satan wants us to be blinded. He really wants us to be blinded. But it doesn't work because God, our strength doesn't come from any God. That's Wild Bill?
Yes, it is.
All right.
Probably hear me breathing in the background here. I got this chest coat and head coat still just a little bit. But one of the things that always intrigues me is how that we get into certain habits that we end up, if we're not careful, we take God completely out of it. You don't read anything here as they fell away from God where they stopped doing their feast days. You don't hear anything about where they stopped doing their sacrifices. You know, all the things that went along with the temple, those things went on for several years, you know, after this. And so I get to thinking about us. You know, we go to church, we talk about plan of salvation, but then we sort of stop right there. And when you understand that sin is missing the mark, then it makes us understand that there's a whole lot more to this than just being born again. God never intended for us to be babes. He wants us to be adult Christians, striving for the mark, keeping focused on Him, and each of us has gifts and callings in our lives that He wants us to take advantage of. Everybody couldn't be Samson. You know, everybody couldn't be Daniel in the lion's den. Everybody couldn't be David with the giant. But there is situations that come up where God can use you if you are obedient to His word and to His will. But when you're just going through the motions, like Samson did, you got this talent, got this calling in your life, and you never really achieve what it is you were supposed to achieve. And so we get to thinking about salvation, and we want to say, well, I've been baptized in Jesus' name. I've been filled with the Holy Ghost. I repented of my sins. But then if it becomes just a habit, just like doing the sacrifices of just going back, yeah, on a certain date, I did all these things, and you're not continuing to live for God, you're not continuing to grow, you're not continuing to obey, we could end up being just like Samson if we're not careful. And I think that's sort of where the church is. We're all content to do things in our own way, and we look at it and we see it as good, and we don't want anyone to tell us that we're wrong, and we don't want to use the sin word whenever we fall or whenever we fail. You know, we'd rather go on and just keep doing what we're doing and act like everything's okay. And there's going to come a day where there's going to be a God that's a good judge, and he used Samson. Yeah, right there at the end, he granted him his wish, gave him his revenge, but it wasn't what it was supposed to be. It missed the mark of what God had planned for him. And so I just want to encourage each and every person to stop and take a look at your life. Ask God to open you up, reveal you, show you where you are right now. And then you talk to God about it and make sure that you're following the path. It's not just the path of the least resistance, but the path that God wants you to walk. And that's really all I had to add to the show tonight. You know, the story pretty much speaks to itself. I do think it's interesting that, you know, people say women can't be used of God. And here one of the judges, you know, was a woman. That's one of those things that always, I think people get hung up on a word or a phrase or an ideology that had to do with the time that these people lived in. And they don't understand that we're in a totally different time, different disposition and everything now. But anyway, we love you, Blog Talk Mom. We thank you for all that you add to the show. And I've got to get ready to boogie on out and go play in the weather tonight. So that's all I have.
Well, that's beautiful. I really think, you know, I always say you have the icing for the cake. But it is, I've... As you know, my favorite chapter right now this whole year has been Psalms 119, and we can become, and I feel this in myself. I'm not pointing fingers at anybody, but we can get caught up in just not a ritual. It's not really a ritual. We're doing what we believe is right, but it doesn't have the same feeling as I think that I want my relationship with God to be fresh. I don't want it to be just a ritual. I want it to be. I don't want him getting the leftovers of any part of my life. And in Psalms 119, in the 17th verse, it says, "Deal bountifully with your servant that I may live and keep your word. Open my eyes that I may see wondrous things from your law." And it's just, you know, continually to know and to realize it's deeper than we'll, and wider and higher and more awesome than we'll ever. We won't overstep it. And I really want to be that reflection of the light of God. And I noticed, just as sort of an object lesson, the situation in America about Christmas. And, of course, when I was younger, we had Christmas. And then when I was, had our family, Wild Bill, Joy, and Jim, we had Christmas and gifts and had a beautiful tree. And then we attended a church that really looked into the paganism that was involved in Christmas and abstained from it completely. There was great blessing in that. There was great insight in that. And then in my life, moving to different churches and moving to different philosophies, I have viewed it from every point that, unless there's something else that God would want to show me. But now there's nothing about, there's no, you know, anywhere in this area I haven't seen a nativity scene. Everything is Santa Claus or, you know, that type of thing, lights and trees and whatever. And it's fascinating to me to just look at how from year to year what sets the stage for what we believe. Is it our relationship with God, or is it just the way that life is, just the way that the big stores set up their decorations? My point is that we must seek God all the time to have an absolute obedient, not that we want to be right up on that 12 o'clock thing. We don't want to be on 5 after 12 or 10 after or 15. We want to be right up there where God is God and he's our God, and we're going to serve him with all of our heart, all of our soul, all of our mind, and all of our strength. This is required. This is what Jesus taught, to seek him first. And then other things will be added, for sure. But as you read the Psalms 119, here it says in the 25th verse, "My soul clings to the dust." There's just something about that life and the way everything is around us. We sort of cling to that. It rubs off on us. I mean, that's just the way it is. But then it says, "Revive me." It goes right on to say, "Lord, revive me." And we always preach, we want revival in our land. We want revival in our churches. We want revival in America. I want revival in me. And Sister Lively, revive me according to your word. And to get before God and say, I've declared my ways now. Lord, answer me. Teach me. Make me to understand. Help me to meditate on your wonderful works. You know, it just, that's so beautiful to me. That's just real. It's like breathing. I can tell you how wonderful it is to breathe. Oh, it's awesome to breathe. I love to breathe. I can tell you fresh air is just awesome. But if I don't breathe, I'm going to die. And I can know all of these things about God and all of these experiences and all of these miracles. But if I don't partake of him, because he said to some of them, he said, I don't even know you. said, well, we did miracles in your name. We did all. He said, I don't even know you. That, what is he saying? God knows everything. There is not that relationship that God is speaking to America, all over the world for sure. But, oh, could we turn back? Could we turn back and love him with all of our heart? And not, you know, sure, God redeemed everything, that the message that Samson did, because God is a God of love and a God of mercy. But, oh, what would have happened if he had really obeyed God and used that, as Wild Bill brought out so beautifully, that was given to him and trusted to him, so that he could be in this world what God intended him to be. So thank you again. I thoroughly enjoy these programs. They're just so many ways of looking at things, that so that we don't just get into the routine of what we say. So thank you, Sister Starla and Wild Bill, and I am through also.
Well, thank you for what you add to the show each week. Blog Talk Mom, and we love you, and Wild Bill. We want to thank our listeners for being with us each week, and we'll see you back here next week at your place. Good night.